Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave even the Bheels an opportunity to chant the holy name and come to the platform of ecstatic love. Thus he delivered all of them. Who has the power to understand the transcendental pastimes of the Lord? Purport by His Divine Grace. As evidence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, we are experiencing that the people of Africa are taking to Krishna consciousness, chanting and dancing and taking prasadam like other Vaishnavas. This is all due to the power of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Who can understand how his potency is working all over the world? Let's all chant Mangalacharan. Om Agyante Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yata Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagnaram Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sarvadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padhan Sahagna Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Paramami Hari Priye Pancha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shiva Sadigaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I'm going to go back to verse 52 and read the translations from there. So this is for those of you who don't know where we are. Lord Chaitanya is traveling to Vrindavan. And as he's traveling through to Vrindavan, he passes through many, many different places. So in text 52, it says, in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally toured Bengal, East Bengal, Orissa, and the southern countries. And he delivered all kinds of people by spreading Krishna consciousness. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Jharkhand, which is a forest, on his way to Mathura, he found that the people there were almost uncivilized and were devoid of God consciousness. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave even the Bheels an opportunity to chant the holy name and come to the platform of ecstatic love. Thus he delivered all of them. Who has the power to understand the transcendental pastimes of the Lord? I do not want to overlook the purport for verse 53 because I was asked to comment on that. But I felt it was important to take 53 and 54 together, both the purports. So the purport to 53, Srila Prabhupada says, the word Bhila refers to a class of men belonging to the Bheels. The Bheels are like black Africans, and they are lower than Shudras. Such people generally live in the jungle, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had to meet them. The purport for verse 54 says, as evidence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, we are experiencing that the people of Africa are taking to Krishna consciousness, chanting and dancing and taking prasadam like other Vaishnavas. This is all due to the power of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Who can understand how his potency is working all over the world? Before I get to the purport of verse 54, I do want to address the purport for verse 53. Because this is the kind of purport that can be taken out of context, misunderstood, be framed as controversial, when it is just a simple statement. Reading is at the heart of our bhakti. It is essential. It is essential because we want to read and hear, because we must spiritualize the intelligence. Because when the mind is firing off, giving us every reason under the sun to not take shelter, the spiritual intelligence needs to be strong to be able to argue with the mind. There are different ways to approach Shastra. One can approach Shastra emotionally, one can approach Shastra through inspiration, one can approach Shastra academically, one can approach Shastra devotionally. There are different ways to approach Shastra, but how we approach Shastra determines what we receive. Because Shastra is alive, Shastra is a person. Just like how you approach a person is going to determine what you receive. So let's look at this. This is a comparative statement, okay? The word Bhila refers to a class of men belonging to the Bhils. It's a community. The Bhils are like black Africans. That is a comparative statement. Helps to give us some description. And then there's a separate statement, and they're lower than Shudras. Such people generally live in the jungle, and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had to meet them. There are a lot of different things being said here, but if you take them as one sentence and connect them for any other reason than wanting to actually see what Srila Prabhupada is telling us, then one could be left with confusion. So this is a comparative statement. That's all it is. Judgment is in the perception of the reader. Okay? Comparison pains us when we evaluate our self-worth by that measure, whether it's a comparison of color, a comparison of gender, a comparison of occupation, a comparison of stage of life. Bhagavatam, CC, Bhagavad Gita, whether it's the verses or the purports, are replete, full of comparisons. Okay? And ultimately, all of these comparisons point us to one thing. It doesn't matter what's good, bad, ugly, politically correct, not politically correct, a comfortable situation or an uncomfortable situation. In this human experience, we are not going to be comfortable, not for very long. And none of those are qualifying criteria for devotional service, and none of them are disqualifying criteria for devotional service. When we read comparative statements with judgment, when we have prejudice, we evaluate others' worth by that measure. Okay, so comparative statements in themselves don't turn a person into a sexist, a racist, or make them loathe themselves. Comparative statements are just comparative statements. It's the transient ego, the false ego. That's what makes us, you know, prejudiced, sexist, racist, and actually makes us even dislike ourselves based on how other people evaluate us. So really, if you look at this statement with a neutral eye, and a neutral eye is a detached eye, yes? That my self-worth is not based solely on my bodily designations. This is talking about a group of people who would be unfamiliar with Vedic culture because they live in the jungle. They're going to be, if you live in the jungle, you're unfamiliar with human culture. Anybody seen Jungle Book? Right? Mowgli's raised by wolves. You all smiled, you laughed, you giggled about it. None of you felt offended by Jungle Book. You watched it, it was a nice story. But he was raised by wolves, he lived in the jungle, so he lived with, had affection with, communicated like the gorillas and the monkeys and the wolves and the bears. He knew what to do. He was the king of the jungle. That was his kingdom. But when he was put in civilization, he didn't know what to do. He had to learn how to eat and speak and all of these things. He needed a new language, a new way of dressing, and it felt alien to him. So we're talking about Bhils. Prabhupada's pointing out that they're unfamiliar, right? So Prabhupada needs to make a comparison for us to bring us to that scenario, to help us to be with the pastime. Right? So you might say, okay, we're here in this room and, you know, there's white ceilings and there's brown doors, right? If somebody was reading about today and we made a diary entry, and we wanted to bring the person into the room. And I wanted to describe, okay, the room was full of people who ranged, were various colors of beige. Okay. You know, someone in the future might go, what do you mean? Why are you calling me beige? You know, there were many people from India or this country or that country, and somebody who's there, whose country wasn't mentioned, might go, oh, you didn't mention me, I'm from Ukraine. And, you know, why wasn't... So do you see Prabhupada's trying to bring us... he's describing this as a group who are unfamiliar because they live in the jungle. They look like black Africans. This is a description, so you can imagine what they look like. And then there's a separate statement. They are lower than Shudras, and they're lower than Shudras. He's not saying black Africans are lower than Shudras. He's saying the Bheels are. Why? Particularly this group of Bheels. If you live in the jungle, are you contributing to society? No, you're not, are you? General, you know, humans. I don't even think people who live in the jungle are counted in our census. Okay? So if you look at Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmana, in terms of occupation, their contribution or their skill is based on what do they contribute to day-to-day society. Okay? So to say someone is lower than the Bheels are lower than Shudras, it's because they don't contribute to society, not because they're worthless. They're clearly not worthless. Lord Chaitanya gave them pure devotional service. Do you see what I mean? So, and Prabhupada's just saying that such people generally live in the jungle. They generally live in the jungle. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had to meet them. He met everyone. Actually, if you came to the previous classes, you'll know that in the previous verses, Srila Prabhupada's very emphatic, and the verses are very emphatic that by the potency of the sound vibration of someone's purity of chanting, literally just by that sound, people become Vaishnavas. People get pure devotional service. Being a Vaishnava isn't being part of a religious group. It's not about how you dress. It's not about what language you speak. It doesn't matter, you know, what color, race, gender, where you started off, whether you took birth in the movement, whether you didn't take birth in the movement. It's not down to that. Being a Vaishnava is you are sold out to dedicating your life to realizing who you are, who Krishna is, and reigniting unconditional love in your life before you even leave your body. So there is... One may receive, what I'm trying to say is this is a comparative statement. One may receive it as a controversial statement, but it's not meant to be controversial. Now, when we look at Shastra, there is a very human side to interpreting Shastra, right? And there is also a divine side to interpreting Shastra, which is not interpretation, it's revelation. So there's two sides, right? There's our interpretation of it. How do I see this? How do I understand this? And this is actually the human interpretation of sacred texts is known as hermeneutics. Yes? And divine understanding of sacred texts is revelation. So hermeneutics is objective. Revelation is personal, is subjective. Shri Radha Gokul Nanda ki jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Gaurinthai ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. If you want to know more about hermeneutics, our Shastric Advisory Board have, you know, put together a very comprehensive hermeneutics course. You can get it on YouTube, and Urmila Devi has produced a 300-page amazing PDF on hermeneutics. I wish I could say that I've become an expert or read those or watched them. I haven't. My understanding of hermeneutics is basic, but it's enough to support the majority of us to make sure that when we read, we are really hearing what Srila Prabhupada and Krishna are trying to tell us. So hermeneutics, so when we read, when we hear, there's an objectivity and human side to it. Okay, when we make the human side subjective, it's going to be full of the four defects. Yes, propensity to make mistakes, propensity to cheat, to come under illusion, and imperfect senses. So we don't want to have the human side to be subjective and too personal, because it's going to be rife full of whatever is important to us in our life right now. We want the human side to be objective, and this is where hermeneutics is important. But we want the spiritual side Okay, we want the divine side of reading to be personal. We want the revelation to be personal, because then it's Krishna to us and us to Krishna, and Guru to us and us to Guru. And that's transcendental. That can bypass and override all of our shortcomings in the body and the mind and in society. Both happen simultaneously. Okay, both happen simultaneously. Krishna takes responsibility for revelation. He says, as you surrender, you get the knowledge of how to come to me. Okay, so he says, I'll take responsibility of that. Okay, I'll take responsibility for the revelation. But are we taking responsibility, you know, checking, first of all, what are my motives when I read and what are my qualifications? And secondly, am I actually reading objectively? Okay, so hermeneutics is essentially the theory and method of interpreting particularly sacred texts. It helps us to understand this. I'm not usually an academic type preacher in the temple context. I tend to do that more outside. But for today, I do think this is something really helpful, because we are at the start of Purushottam. And reading is something people do more of in Purushottam. And so I really hope I can give you something that shares something that helps you to go deeper with your reading. And deeper doesn't always mean more time. It means more surrender and more openness to what we're hearing and reading. So what hermeneutics does, and this is what we're trying to do here, we're trying to bridge the gap between ancient wisdom and ancient knowledge and ancient authors. God is the oldest author. Yes? Krishna is the oldest author. Srila, even if you bring it to Srila Prabhupada, still the Srila Prabhupada's books are at least, you know, the newest are 50 years old. Yes, so in one sense, that's historical and ancient. Ask a 10-year-old, they'll say that's really ancient. You know, to an 18-year-old, I'm really ancient. So it bridges the gap between modern readers and ancient authors, okay? So there are four types of meaning when we look at sacred texts. First one, and this is important, is the literal or grammatical. Okay, so you're looking at the word order, the grammar. What does this literally say? Okay, so we've read the verses and we've read Prabhupada's purport of what could be a controversial statement, but come to the conclusion this is comparative. That's all it is, because we've checked the grammar. We've, you know, seen that he's used the power of and, you know. So this is important, word order and grammar. So often we'll get questions about something in a purport or a text, and the answer is literally there. It's in the sentence or it's in the purport. But because someone's overlooked a comma or a full stop or an and or an or, they've missed the answer. Okay, so this is important, the literal and grammatical. Of course, that's important. Now, all these four have to be taken together. The second one is historical setting. Okay, the actual events. What was the original author trying to convey? So when we're looking at CC, we're looking at, okay, what's Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami trying to convey? What's Srila Prabhupada trying to convey? And ultimately, what is Krishna trying to convey? Then there's two types of context, okay? One context is the literary context. What is this verse or this purport saying in the context of this chapter, okay? And perhaps this section of the CC or this section of Lord Chaitanya's life, or in the context of the verses that came before and the verses that come afterward. And then the last but not least, the theological context. Where does this fit with the theology overall? Does this synchronize? This was why Srila Prabhupada was so strong on Bhagavad Gita as it is. He wanted to make sure that all of Krishna's statements were interpreted with the purpose of bringing us back to him, which is what Krishna's purpose was. Not that Krishna's some mythological character, these allegorical stories, that, you know, we are God. Just these, you know, these are like off-road interpretations. They don't fit. Okay, so hermeneutics is just, you can ask yourself when you're reading, especially if you find something you've read challenging. If it's a challenge, that is coming from the mind and ego. And you can take yourself through these four things. Let me go through these four things. And as your mind becomes pacified, as your intelligence becomes stronger, Krishna's revelation will come to the surface much more. You'll be more receptive to his revelation. See, how, so that, but the contention here isn't in the verses. The verses are quite simple. It's just describing Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu coming to Jharkhand forest. He meets a group of people. He even though they live in the jungle, he gives them devotional service. What are we hearing? This is wonderful. There's nothing controversial. There's no contention here. The contention here isn't in the verses, but it's in the purports. So how do we apply the above to Srila Prabhupada's purports? I.e., how do we apply this to contentious statements from the spiritual master? We have to, in this case, think about why did Srila Prabhupada write books? Why did Srila Prabhupada write books? What was his relationship with the world? Why did Srila Prabhupada write books? Tell me, why do you think Srila Prabhupada wrote books? Why did Srila Prabhupada only sleep 2-3 hours? To teach us? Anyone else? His spiritual master asked him to. Wonderful. Any other reasons? Compassion, Jagatpriya? Yes, so to ensure that the knowledge doesn't get lost. Anyone else? He became immortal. He lives through his books. He became immortal through his books. It would be good if we had the roaming mic, please. Anyone else? Thank you, Shakti Gopi. Yes, he wanted to give us some support through Kali Yuga because he knew it was going to be hard. Srila Prabhupada was writing as a guru. He wasn't writing as an author of fiction or of non-fiction. He wasn't writing books for entertainment. He wasn't writing books to be a New York Times bestseller. He wasn't pandering to a publisher's editing scrutiny based on how many books he will sell. Okay, he was not trying to be politically correct or woke. He was being guru. When guru speaks and guru writes, what is the purpose of guru? Guru has one aim. Why does guru mean heavy? Heavy on the transient and false ego. You look at the statements of Shastra, whether they're spoken by Krishna or his devotees. Look at Srila Prabhupada's purports. It is inevitable. You will find something that will burn you. It will make you feel uncomfortable. Why? Because that's what guru does. Guru pulls out all the things that we are attached to. Because when we hear something and makes us feel uncomfortable, we're attached, either through fear, aversion, or affection. So many other ways. What was his relationship with the world? He wasn't here, you know, to become the biggest selling author of time, of all time. He didn't care about that. He didn't need that validation. He was Jagat Guru. He is Jagat Guru. So his words are going to burn. Okay? They're going to burn, but they're also going to cool. Because they extinguish this material fire burning in our hearts, right? So they're burning and cooling. They burn the false ego and they revive and refresh and water the real ego. Okay, so we have to remember when we hear Guru's words, either written or spoken, and one's mind goes, that's not very politically correct, that's not very woke, what would people think? I should protect my spiritual master by rephrasing what my spiritual master has said or what this teacher has said or what Prabhupada has said. We have to be very, very careful that we don't lose the potency and the purification that comes from having the false ego burned. Okay? It doesn't feel good to compromise the false ego. Right, but now this is not to say that we should encourage cruel behavior from spiritual masters or lack of kindness on the student, but the words of guru, the behavior of guru, the consciousness of guru, through both words and actions, the pain points of the student are made obvious. Yes? If I look at my life as a physician, right? If I'm examining someone physically, I have to find their pain points. I have to poke them. I have to palpate. Okay? Why? Because it helps me to assess where the pain is and what type of pain it is, and then from that I can see what the disease is. Yes? Right? So somebody else watching going, well, you're so cruel. They told you it hurts there. Why are you poking it more? I'm the physician. That's my job. When I see a patient for mental health problems, right? Again, I'm pressing for pain points. I push. I dig for detail, for feelings. Find the things that they can't see. They even say to me, why do you make me cry? You know, I haven't cried before. You made me cry. You hardly say anything. Just say the right thing to bring out what the trouble is. Why? Because when we see what the trouble is, we can find the solution. Okay? So, who here likes to read? Just generally likes to read. Put your hands up. Okay, right? You enjoy it, and some of you have not put your hands up, clearly. Okay, maybe just don't like reading. It's not something you like. People who like reading, they are used to joyfully reading. And you look at society, most books are written to feel joyful when you're reading. Either you're feeling joyful because it's bringing you leisure or it's entertaining you, or you're joyful because it's educating you, okay? But when you read for purification, it's not always joyful. Do you see what I mean? When you're reading to make a change, it's not joyful. See, it's funny because we come here to be happy, right? We even join this community to be happy. Look at these, even today in the wonderful kirtan this morning. Everybody was so joyful. Everybody was so happy. They forgot their, you know, individual little spats and their confusion that they came into the temple with. And then we go back to it, you know, once everything's over. But we see all these joyful people. We see everybody joyfully eating, joyfully sharing. And oh, I want that joy. I want that happiness. And we join, okay? And we join because why? What's attractive? We see people feel loved. We see people feel loved. Right? We're wandering from corner to corner, birth after birth, different stages of our life, just trying to find someone who's going to love us, who's going to put us in the center. So when we see someone who's happy, or we see a group of people who are happy, these people must be really feeling loved, right? Because, you know, spiritual life, it's... Paik Thirta Maharaj describes if we live in the spiritual paradigm and actually we live our life as a spiritual life, we are essentially enrolling in the school of love. Because, now hear me out, this is not just some romantic, you know, sentimental thing here. Think about it. Our goal, what is the goal of Krishna consciousness? It's not a place, is it? I want to go to Goloka Vrindavan, it's already here. So you're not going anywhere. Goloka Vrindavan's in your heart. If Krishna's in your heart, then everything, even Vrindavan, is in your heart. So, it's not a location. Our goal isn't an achievement. No one's going to give us a certificate or a trophy. Okay, our name is not going to go on a plaque. In fact, we can't achieve devotional service. We receive devotional service. Our goal is prem. Prem is unconditional love. Our goal is a feeling, an experience. Our goal is a relationship. So it's inevitable if our goal is to love Krishna and everyone connected to him, including ourselves, okay? Then it's inevitable our ability to do that is going to be tested by having our prejudices weeded out. Because our prejudices against ourselves and other people. And believe you me, if you're honest with yourself, you have prejudices against yourself. There are things you wish that you weren't. But if you wish too hard that you're not those things, you're going to have to just take another body so you can be all the things that you wish you were. Why? So you can sit in another class where you've got another verse you found, which is now contentious to that body, why do it all again? Okay, so it's inevitable in a school of love, you know. School means learning. It means making mistakes. It means taking tests. But it also means passing tests. And it means graduating. And graduating in Krishna consciousness and graduating from this school of love means becoming constantly connected to love. So much so that it's literally spilling out of us. There is no room for prejudice. This is what it feels like to be Krishna conscious. To be so connected to receiving divine love that you don't give it away. It just flows from you. This is what Lord Chaitanya was doing. Everywhere he was going, just by chanting Krishna's name, just by standing there, just by looking at someone, that vibration of the holy name, the purity of it, was transforming hearts. It was literally antimatter, antimaterial. Anything material in the consciousness, in the body, in the mind, gone. Literally dissolved. You know Srila Prabhupada? Let's come back to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada loved so much. I've heard so many of his disciples say that one of the things that changed them and that made them surrender to Srila Prabhupada was when they heard him speak and they saw him. They said, this is a person who knows God personally. This is a person who experiences God's love personally. They felt it, you know. And he always felt that love from Krishna in whichever way Krishna expressed it to him. He was ready to receive it. So when we're reading, if Krishna's motive is love, if Guru's motive is love, and we're not talking about, you know, Hollywood love or Bollywood love, we're talking about love, the spiritual force, the state of being and state of existence that constantly asks, what about you? Right? Lust asks, what about me? It's a needy position. I need, I want. That's simply all lust is. And that is human and material consciousness, always in need. But spiritual consciousness is, what about you? How can I serve? Because it comes from a place of fullness. If we are connected to the reservoir of all love, consistently, continuously, or to the degree that we are, to that degree we are constantly being topped up. Compassion fatigue is not a thing. Yeah, love fatigue is not a thing when you're constantly being topped up. But if you're reliant simply on your own psychosocial abilities, then compassion fatigue is a thing. And there's a limit to what we can do. So when we read, you know, the way we read is a measure of how much we are plugged in. When you read, ask yourself, do you feel love coming through or judgment? Because what we receive or what we see is a reflection of our consciousness. Just like we hear, the people around us are a mirror, holding up a mirror for our stuff. Shastra does the same thing. Classes do the same thing. Okay? So what I'm inviting all of us to do here, especially this month where, you know, we have this special month, comes every 3 years. This month does a wonderful service of balancing out the lunar and the solar calendars. In fact, so wonderful is this month that Krishna assigns his own name, Purushottam, to this month. So whenever Krishna assigns or gives special shelter to a person, even a calendar month, the personality of a calendar month, that personality or that period of time or whatever Krishna's given a specific shelter to becomes embodied and bestowed with extra potency. So we normally, you know, really take shelter of Kartik or Damodar month, but also this Purushottam month is a time when devotees at least increase your quality if you can't increase your quantity. And we can improve the quality of our reading. Okay? Let's try and move away from trying to understand the eternal through a temporary lens. Let's try and move away from understanding statements that are filled with love through the eyes of lust. Because actually, we're reading this statement today. We could read it in 50 years, in 100 years. We could have read it 200 years ago. And you could ask yourself, are these statements racist? Are they sexist? Are they non-politically correct? Some statements in the Bhagavatam, in the Gita, in the CC, whether they're verses or purports, today might not be politically correct. They may be perfect in 100 years. They could have been perfect 50 years ago. It's relative, okay? This is the problem with trying to read eternal through relative, is you can't. The message of Shastra is eternal. It is evergreen. It always applies. The pinch points change depending on our conditioning, not from the statement itself, okay? So we have to also ask ourselves, are they necessary? Someone could say again, was it necessary? Was it necessary to make these comparisons? Is it necessary to make these contentious statements? Of course it is, because the guru is supposed to find your pinch points. Srila Prabhupada didn't make this comparative statement saying, okay, well, let's describe the Beatles like this because I want to write a pinch point. He's not writing like that. He's writing like, let me take everyone to that exact time and place when Lord Chaitanya was there. Let me bring them into that forest and make them feel like they're there with him. So he has to give us a description, right? So, are they necessary? Everything that comes out of Guru's mouth is necessary, especially Jagat Guru. All of it's necessary. Will they make you more Krishna conscious? Question is, of course they will make you more Krishna conscious, but how quickly will they make you Krishna conscious depends on how you read. Because actually, if you look at this, these verses, they're actually inspiring. These verses are amazingly inspiring. Every town and village, everyone, there isn't a corner of this world where there's anyone who has any quality that excludes them from devotional service. So what are we hearing? It doesn't matter if you don't contribute to society. It doesn't matter if you can't speak the language. It doesn't matter if you're uncivilized. It doesn't matter if you're lower than you should. It just doesn't matter if you have no value. Doesn't matter, your lack of value still makes you qualified, right? No credentials are required. Even when unfamiliar with the culture, the process works because there is a person behind the process and his name is Krishna. And Krishna has no obstacles in reaching our hearts. We put up the obstacles. So if you find something contentious, remember, that's your wall. You can go back to hermeneutics, or you can just do the process that works for you. If you feel a burn, figure it out. Talk to devotees. But really try and understand what is Srila Prabhupada trying to do here? What is he trying to do for us? So I know this. Everything I've said may not satisfy you completely. You may have other ideas. You may have other thoughts. You may have read other things that have made you feel uncomfortable. So I want to leave. That's why I wanted to make sure I left some time to invite your comments, your questions, even your critique and corrections. If you are, my request though, is please, if you are going to share something that you have contention with, please make it accurate, okay? Give the actual verse, give the place, because too many times people paraphrase. Because actually, if you look at it, you know, and sorry, I will come back to you. This particular purport, especially when we move to 54, where Srila Prabhupada talks about how even those who are unfamiliar with the process can take to the process so easily, like as if they've been doing it their whole lives. This is what Srila Prabhupada wanted to do. He wanted to make Krishna consciousness accessible to everybody. Why would he intentionally put statements which would block people off? Why would he do that? In fact, Srila Prabhupada's love is so alive, even long after he left, he was still making Krishna consciousness available to everybody. So Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he was one of the, significant people preaching in Africa. You know how he decided to preach in Africa and when he decided? It's far out. It's far out. He was preaching in Washington, doing some, you know, setting up some communities, trying to connect with the African-American community, actually, in Washington, D.C., which is very big and very intellectual. And he was living in very austere conditions. And one night, he had a dream. In that dream, Srila Prabhupada and him were in a room in a house. And there was a knock on the door. Srila Prabhupada looked at Bhaktivedanta Swami and he said, "Open the door." Bhaktivedanta Maharaj opened the door, and in front of him was an ocean of African people. Like an ocean. It was like he was looking at the whole country. And he looked at Srila Prabhupada and Srila Prabhupada said, "Let them all in. Let them all in." Who else has let everybody in? You, me, all of us here. Would we have had a chance to do this if it wasn't for Srila Prabhupada? Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, the next day, he got a flight and went to Africa. The next day. That is fulfilling the order of the spiritual master. The next day. You know? This instant. Guru says, jump, we jump. Okay? So it's just Prabhupada's love is accessible. Whether it's through his books, whether it's through his classes, whether it's through your dreams, he is not restricted by time and space. You don't have to have met him physically, okay? You needn't have met him physically for him to be able to influence your life, for him to give you personal instruction. Make your effort to be as open as possible to his words this Purushottam month, okay, this Purushottam month. You will get so much reciprocation because this is spiritual life on steroids this month, okay? Extra interest from Krishna. And it's all right if you find some statements contentious. It's supposed to hurt. But then we want to heal from that hurt and find your way to actually, okay, how can I soothe this pain? Not just to feel good about myself in this world, but actually get to the root cause of the disease. Don't close your books when you come across a contentious point. Don't close your books if you find it boring. I'll tell you, as a psychiatrist, when people are bored, that's a sign of resistance. Okay? There's something in your psyche, something in your mind that is stopping you from reading on. Not boring. My God, learning about what's going on in Krishna's life, in our real life, what's going on even in this material universe, it's just amazing. It's amazing. Not boring. If you get bored, what's the resistance? Ask yourself that. It's very important to understand the vehicle that Krishna's given you. Okay? Don't close your books. Hare Krishna. Don't be shy. There's a roaming mic. Please put your hand up if you'd like to say something and we'll pass the mic around. Oh, wow, quite a few hands up. Good. Good. Still can't hear you.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much for the class. Perhaps I've asked this question to you in person in the past, but my main concern is for people who've not necessarily accepted Srila Prabhupada as a guru and are not very skilled in hermeneutics, for example, the many people we meet on book distribution. And I've actually encountered a couple of people who've raised similar contentious points. So clearly, the many people whom we distribute books to, they are being affected. So I'm just wondering if you're happy to raise anything on this in terms of how such people may not, may see these statements in terms of the context they are in and not be affected.
I mean, your question is a very good one, because if devotees who have surrendered to Srila Prabhupada are affected, of course people who haven't surrendered to Srila Prabhupada will be affected. People who haven't surrendered to Krishna will be affected. But that's the purpose of spiritual books. They're meant to leave us affected in some shape or form, right? The thing is, until we become fine-tuned to spiritual consciousness and live in spiritual consciousness, at least most of the time, if not all the time, we don't recognize the way the process is working. Most of how the holy name and the sacred texts work at us is imperceptible. Imperceptible. Okay? I mean, you're a doctor. You know most people can't see the work the antibiotics are doing on them when they take antibiotics for an infection, right? They wait till the symptoms are cleared. So until we're Krishna conscious, at least most of the time, we're going to be affected. And and we're always affected, but the effect we'll notice is the surface level or the disaffect or effect or lack thereof. We won't notice what's actually going on underneath the surface. You touch one of Prabhupada's books, your path to Krishna has begun. You don't even have to have read it. So whether that seed fructifies in this lifetime or another one doesn't really matter. Our lifespan's very short. You know, one whole lifetime of Brahma, which is a lot of years. Okay, a lot of years. It's just one moment for Krishna. It's like a blink of an eye. So now this is not me saying, oh, it doesn't really matter. I'm not trying to minimize it. What I'm trying to point out is the way devotional service works, 99.999% of it is beneath the surface. You have to be living really in that paradigm to recognize it. However, this is one of the reasons why Prabhupada made it so important that you must read my books if you're going to distribute them. Because we're not just there to distribute. We also act as a bridge. We act as a bodyguard, as a gatekeeper, as a protector for Srila Prabhupada, and as a protector for the person who's coming. How can I protect this person's devotional creeper? If I don't read these books, I won't know what they might come upon, which might disturb them. You may even caveat, if you really get into a conversation, you may say, look, there may be some points in here that might irk you, and they may that may come across as not very politically correct. But feel free to get in touch and ask me any questions you might have. That kind of invitation, you will get so many blessings from the parampara, and you'll get the blessings of that person. Because actually, in most religious communities, you're not allowed to ask questions. I've heard it from so many people over the decades that one of the things that's most attractive about Krishna consciousness is the first place they've come to where they're allowed to ask questions, where they're allowed to say, hang on, this feels wrong, or I don't get this, or I find this hard to follow. That's okay, don't worry, just ask your questions, it's okay. It's a sign of intelligence. Oh, doubt was a sign of intelligence, really. You just say to someone that, yes, you're allowed to have an opinion. They will be much more receptive to being corrected. It's like, as a physician, you know, before you examine your patients, you say, this is going to hurt a little bit. I mean, give books, you can say, this might hurt a bit. But people get so caught up in, I want to distribute so many numbers, you lose sight of the person you're distributing to. Better you distribute one, and I know the book distributors might hate me for this, but better you distribute one book really nicely to somebody who's going to go, well, am I really going to read this and really absorb this and get in touch with this person? You know, you can distribute 20 books, but how many of people have you told that, you know, this might hurt, or I'm here for you personally? So we can, and we can do both. It may take a few more minutes, but then Krishna will empower you more and more and more, and he'll bring efficiency to your service where it doesn't take so long. You know, because you'll carry that with you, that I'm here. This might hurt a little bit. We avoid telling people that because, you know, I mean, when someone starts school, you don't have proper lessons anyway. You learn through play, right? But still, that we don't want to lose that. People need to know. They're just like for you. I remember you telling me once that you really think it's important to understand what you're reading and know that it's not all jay nectar bliss, you know, and that Krishna consciousness can be hard, but that people don't talk about these things when they first tell you about Krishna consciousness. But just like you're like that, there'll be other people like that, and Krishna will send those people to you. So you preach to them the way it suits you to be preached to. And same for anybody else. Krishna will send, you know, devotees to you that you are perfectly suited to preach to. perfectly suited. Thank you. Vishwamba Prabhu? No? Two of you? Both of you? At the same time? No.
It was very, a very interesting class. Usually on weekend, before I go out on books, you know, I hear the class online. But this one, I just came in, and you exercise really deep intelligence on your application. So your Guru Maharaj must be very pleased with your style of preaching. I have a question that. I asked Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and of course the GBC, they had the meetings about it, and there was no, it didn't really bother me, but and Shivaram Swami got involved. But I would like to ask, you know, your opinion about this. Yeah, you said whatever comes out from the mouth of the guru, it's necessary, and we can analyze that the way he writes what we read from the guru. Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I got this, for example, I got the second initiation, and my Guru Maharaj asked me in Vrindavan to pose my ear to whisper the Gayatri Mantra, and I put my left ear. You know where I'm going with
this. Yes. It's okay, but you have to tell everyone else.
And he said, no, the right ear. Now, I remember as a brahmachari, fanatically, I used to read and make notes about, you know, the fourth canto. You said if we ask question, we have to back it up, you know, with the quote and the place where we... So I found this little interesting paragraph, Srila Prabhupada, the fourth canto, description of King Puranjan, that the Devahu, the left ear, Pitrihu is the right ear. Is the left ear is auspicious because it's connected to the Swamsa, the heart, mm-hmm. Paramatma. And we receive the Gayatri Mantra from the spiritual master. So that's why I put my left ear. He said, no, the right ear. But I didn't argue. But afterwards, I brought it up to him. And he said, that's very interesting, because Srila Prabhupada used to give Gayatri Mantra on the right ear to his disciples, but he wrote it down in the Bhagavatam, the left ear. It's the prerequisite, you know, to receive the Gayatri Mantra. Mm. It didn't bother me, you know. I accept, when I see controversy, I accept them as a mystical, one day I will understand.
It's made sure that you didn't forget that purport, right? All these years later.
No. My question to you, it's something else. Well, should we pay more attention in following the legacy of the guru in what he says or in what he writes? Because which one has got more power and potency? If he did, you know, given that sometimes we find a little contradiction.
Yes.
Which doesn't bother me personally. So I don't want anyone to get disturbed about this. But Shivaram Swami gave a very interesting theory. But I want to know from you.
What did Shivaram Maharaj say?
He said when the guru faced the disciple face to face, then the left becomes the right, and the right becomes... Which made a bit of a sense to me. It's like, you know, I'm looking at you, and your right ear is my left, and your left ear is my right. So it's Yeah, it's something I accepted, no problem. But
what do we put emphasis on? Yeah, I got your question.
Sometimes if there is a little apparent contradiction.
Yes.
Which one should we follow? What the guru did, or what the same guru wrote?
Yes, that's a really good question, and it's important because Srila Prabhupada's a Jagat Guru. So we always go back to him as our reference point, especially if there may be discrepancy amongst our Shiksha or Diksha gurus, right? So I like Shri Ramaraj's answer.
He said that it's interesting because Prabhupada gave it to me in the right ear, Tamal Krishna Maharaj. It's interesting. And he found it quite, he wanted to know what that mystical...
I mean, look, I'll come to your question about... what do we give more importance to? But even just this point about right ear, left ear. I mean, it's a good point. Your, right becomes my left, etc. But yes, the left side is the side of reception. It is. We know this energetically, metaphysically, etc. My understanding, those Vedic mantras are received through our right ear. But whichever way you look at it, there's going to be a heart connection. Okay? So... But in terms of importance of where do we put emphasis, and I think this is an important area of discussion, because we don't just have Prabhupada's lectures available, we have his books available, and we have his letters available. Now, with lectures, he is speaking to a particular audience, but it's still general. He's giving something for everyone. With the books, he's giving something for everyone, for all time. With letters, he's giving something specific for the person he's writing to. And with a personal interaction, he's giving something specific for the person he's speaking to with. However, when a person, especially guru, does the same thing repeatedly, that then becomes for everybody. It becomes universal and consistent. And so even in the letters... if he's repeatedly writing the same thing for everybody, then that becomes for everybody. So we have to be careful, because what's for everybody is for everybody. And then what's for particular individuals, we have to be careful to not accept that that's for everybody. Because people can get thrown off. Guru is personal. Even Jagat Guru is personal. And if you look at Prabhupada's letters, with some people, he makes adjustments to... because he knows this person, if I don't make this adjustment, they're going to do it anyway, and then they'll suffer and I'll suffer. But if as guru I make an adjustment and allow them, then we're both protected. With others, he knows they're stronger, so he's even stricter, right? So, I mean, the reason, I had this discussion with Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, because when he was leaving, when I was doing all his letters, there was some real nectar in some of those letters. So I asked him, I said, can we make these letters available? And he said, no. He said, these private emails are private, just between me and the person I'm writing to. He said, even for you, even though you're typing them, he said, they're not even for you. He said, so don't keep them. He said, actually, we made a mistake in one sense in the way we've taken Prabhupada's letters, because not everything in Prabhupada's letters is for everyone. So what do we go with? Is it what the Acharya says or the Acharya does? It's both. It's also relevance. And we have to look at whether it's relevant to us and whether it's become precedent through repetition, where it's an individual, act or statement. Then also ultimately with Srila Prabhupada's statements, we have to default to actually what our actual spiritual master wants. We don't override our own guru and say, well, Prabhupada did this. Right? Otherwise, somebody could say, oh, Prabhupada, we're not listening to you because actually Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur did this. Does that make sense? So, yeah, I think this is why we need community to have these kinds of discussions. That is interesting, the right ear and left ear thing. I mean, what would you say when someone has 10 ears? Which is right, which is left?
Lord Brahma, he has 8.
Our one has 8, but then what about the Brahmas with 10 heads and 20 heads, you see? And there's species on this planet that many of us haven't even encountered that have so many different types of ears. If somebody is hearing impaired and you're giving them Gayatri, they'll feel the vibration. They'll feel the vibration of the Gayatri. They won't. Because sound is, it's got many parts. It's got 4 significant ones. One is that which you receive through the ear. that which you feel as a physical vibration, that which is the intention of the person sending it, and then the nature of the sound. Is it spiritual sound? Is it material sound? So there's a lot. There's a lot around the science of sound, and there's a lot going on. There's a lot more people in this room than we can see. I wonder what they make of our conversation about right here and left here. anyone else? Prabhuji, did you want to say something? No, he's just passing the mic around. Oh, you have nothing. I think there was someone here. Any ladies? Anyone have anything? Is Mataji here? What's your name? Kate. Nice to meet Kate.
Thank you for your lecture. I'm new, and I'm sorry if it's a very basic question, but I don't understand.
No such thing.
When you say we receive devotional service, in my understanding, when you serve somebody, it's you taking that action. You're not receiving it. I would be grateful for some elaboration.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect. That is not a basic question. That's a very good question. What do we mean by receiving devotional service? Devotional service is a truly awakened an unconditionally loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Lovehead. Okay, Krishna, he's the Supreme Personality of Love. When you approach a person, and yes, our practices, they're the means, but they're also the end, right? And yes, we have a process, but that process is all about reconnecting, remembering, rediscovering, recovering that love for Krishna. But we also receive it in the sense that we need his permission to love him. Right? And so we receive that permission through those who already have that connection with him fully. This is why Bhakti Devi, devotion, is seen as independent. She's independent. She chooses to allow those who already have her to share her. So this is how we receive devotional service. See, we often talk about spiritual life and or material world and spiritual world actually just being all around us. There's just a veil, a thin veil. But this veil has got two sides. One side of the veil is under our control. It's our effort. How much do we choose to be conditioned, right? By making consistent effort to not be conditioned, we invite Krishna. Yes, he says, as you surrender to me, I tell you how to come to me. So that's our invitation. That's how he measures our surrender, by our effort, not by our result. The other side of the veil is Krishna's concealment. It's Krishna hiding himself. That's under his control. The more we invite Krishna that I'm lifting my side of the veil, the more he is invited and encouraged to lift his side of the veil. He stops concealing himself. There's a verse in the Ishopanishad where, you know, devotee asks Krishna, please remove the effulgence, your effulgence from your face because I can't see you. Yeah, so this material nature, all of these allurements that we have here, so that's all his effulgence. It's blinding us. When we're ready to say, okay, Krishna, I just want to see past this effulgence. I want to see you. And we lift our side of the veil. Then he lifts his, he stops concealing. So it's received. Love is received. There's a couple here. What time is breakfast served? Okay. Please don't, we're not imposing on anyone that you have to stay, but you're more than welcome to stay. Hare Krishna Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. I have two questions. First is, you described the veil just now between Krishna and ourselves and how we need to transcend that veil.
The veil,
the
yes.
Veil, yeah, the veil. Not the veil, sorry. what's the nature of the veil and how does it manifest itself given that the world itself is a beautiful creation, which we really enjoy and is created by Krishna himself, right? So that's the first question. The second question is, what's the nature of free will and how much of it is given to each individual, if at all?
So the veil, There's different ways of explaining the veil. But based on your second question, I'll take a more philosophical approach. So if you look at Maya being Krishna's energy, she also has two sides. There's Mahamaya, so she, you know, interacts with us in this world to keep us here if we want to keep stay here, but also if we want don't want to stay here and we want to reconnect with Krishna, she tests us, okay? She tests us. So that's the interaction between the modes of material nature, our desires, and our false ego. That's the manifestation of this side of the veil, our side, okay? Then the side of concealment from Krishna's side, that's Yogamaya. Okay, that's Radharani. That's his internal potency in her true and essential self. And she also protects Krishna, but she protects Krishna through facilitation and also facilitates us. Because we approach Sita before we approach Ram, we approach Radharani before we approach Krishna. Yes, so she becomes a gateway and a gatekeeper. So Krishna's concealment is still to some degree protected by his most intimate associates. So she's always by his side. She just manifests differently depending on which side of the veil we're standing. And then your question about free will, how much? If you have infinity and I asked you to, what's 10% of infinity, you wouldn't be able to give me a number. So if Krishna's free will is infinite and we have, and he has free will, we have everything he has. Yes, this is what Shastra tells us, this is what Srila Prabhupada explains, but Krishna explains this in the Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, that everything he has, because we are parts and parcels, we also have all of those things but a part. Just like a spark has exactly the same qualities as the fire, but a part. Okay, putting out a fire, you need a fire brigade. To put out a spark, you just do this. But the minute that spark connects with the fire again, it gets all the qualities of the fire. Yes, that strength. So, how much free will does Krishna give us? He gives us enough free will to be able to make a choice as to whether we want to love him or not. And then that manifests in this world with making choices about whether we stay away, okay, because this is our getaway car. Our body and our mind is basically designed and is a sign of our aversion to Krishna. But that same getaway car becomes our vehicle to return to him, right? So he gives us in this world this free will. We express a little bit of free will. We express by staying away or by trying to go back. But that same free will in the spiritual world, we turn every desire to please him, every activity to please him. Our form, just like here, everything is born of feeling. It's the same in our spiritual identity. What we feel for Krishna gives rise to the form we have, the name we have, the service we have, the complexion we have, the dress we have, the group we have, how we feel about Krishna. So you have free will. Use it wisely. And Jay, right? Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna Mataji. Thank you so much for an amazing class. My question has got to do with, in the class you said about how we should not really alter anything that Prabhupada says. We should keep it as it is. And if it's anything that's like, you know, affecting you, that's for your own purification. You can try and see it in that way as well. We also understand that there's a part where I think, if I'm not mistaken, other devotees and also Prabhupada says that the principle should not be changed.
Yes.
But the details can,
yes,
here and there, we, yes, waver a little bit. So how do I understand, not what is the principle, but how do I understand what Prabhupada says, if it can be or it can't be, you know, like if it is the principle or if it is the detail, and if I can change the detail or according to the person that maybe I'm preaching.
How
to
much it. Will the detail change the principle?
Yeah.
Okay. Even if you took the statement we were talking about today, you could ascribe it to any culture. If he'd said the Beals look like South Americans and they're greater than Brahmanas, the principle of actually Lord Chaitanya was sharing, you know, spreading Krishna consciousness in every town and village would still apply. However, it wouldn't be accurate because that's not what the Beals look like. They don't look like South Americans. They lived in the jungle. So they weren't contributing to society. So societally, they wouldn't be greater than Prabhupada. So we don't want to make stuff up just to... Because if you change stuff to suit today's society, in 50 years' time, it's not going to suit people. You know? And then in 100 years' time, what we're saying now might suit people more. In 1,000 years' time, you know, this world is going to change a lot. It's already changed so fast. Since even in the last 5 years, it's changed so much. It is changing at a very fast rate. If we try to keep up with public opinion in terms of changing detail, you will end up losing the principle. So you've got to see if the detail is consistent with the principle. And will you lose something if you remove the detail? But that is not our service to do. As a reader, if it's your service to do that, then you need to be asking these questions. You sit on the Shastak Advisory Committee, you know, you have these discussions. But it is not, as a reader, our decision to decide what is removed or what can be dismissed or what can't be. Nothing should be dismissed. I would say, don't just like really. And I'm telling you this from experience. Every word the spiritual master says is an instruction or a test. If you can live your life like that, you'll be able to overcome anything and you'll achieve Krishna prema. So how do we decide what's necessary detail or unnecessary detail? How much does it impact the principle? But we must be very careful because Prabhupada is doing many things with one thing. I think that's it, so we'll stop there. Thank you so much. Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.